This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome. You are with Counterculture, of course, here with Marie. And joining me now, returning, I can't believe it's been February since we last caught up, Professor Ramesh Thakur from the Brownstone Institute, Senior Scholar, a former United Nations Assistant Secretary General, Emeritus Professor in the Crawford School of Public Policy, the Australian National University, and of course, the author of Our Enemy, the Government. Ramesh, how are you?
I'm good, Marie. Thank you for having me back.
It is great to have you back. We love it when you come and visit us on RCR. You wrote a fantastic piece in Brownstone dated September 6th, Why the Ruling Class Fears Democracy. It opens with the perfect storm of crises has been building. It comes from still bubbling rage with the governments for their single-minded obsession with COVID and the lasting damage caused by lockdowns, masks and vaccine mandates, with the media for amplifying government fear porn and social media platforms for collusion with innovative techniques of censorship, the cost of living pressures, Ukraine war, the crimes, the housing crisis, cultural decay and social dislocations of mass immigration. A survey earlier this year in France, Germany, Italy and Poland found that 60% of voters lack trust in their political institutions. Well, what about our part of the world, Ramesh? Do you think that could be fair to say that trust is disappearing both in Australia and New Zealand?
Well, it's certainly disappearing in Australia. Later on, I do refer to the Edelman Trust Barometer, and the impressions of the Australian media and government have gone down as well. And in fact, there's net minus negative ratings for the government on competence and integrity, etc. But when you read it out, I'm not sure whether it sounds like a cry from the heart or a venting affair. But no, this is something that has bothered me, because if you believe in democracy, as I do, and I point that out towards the end of the article as to why and when that realization really hit home for me. If you believe in democracy, then at the end of the day, you have to trust in the good judgment of the people. Instead, what we have is a growing divide between an elite consensus and discontent amongst what Hillary Clinton famously or infamously called the deplorables. Mm. And rather than sit back and wonder if they might possibly have got it wrong themselves, the elite's response is to tighten up speech and insist that wherever we, the people, differ from what they think is correct, it's a result of us being either misinformed or racist or whatever. But it couldn't possibly be, because the people actually are correct. We saw that with the voice referendum in Australia. I detect from a distance traces of that with regard to anyone who dares to question the extent to which Maori activist demands have been appeased in New Zealand. You certainly see it with the Trudeau government in Canada. You see it with the Democrats in the US. And of course, you have the government taking that line now in the UK. I think the first break in that, possibly at a major level, is actually Germany, where finally the elite seems to have registered that people are not happy with their immigration policies. And on that, incidentally, even in the UK, I don't know if you've seen, but there's a recent, in fact, just last week, I think, a report from the Office for Budget Responsibility, or whatever it's called, the OBR. This time, disaggregating mass immigration, and pointing out that low-skilled, low-wage-earning immigrants will be a net drain on the British taxpayer for the duration of their lives. By the time they end, it's quite, I think it was £150,000 per annum per migrant that will be costing. So it's the high-income, high-wage earners and high-skilled migrants who contribute in net terms to the economy. Whereas, of course, all along the consensus, elite consensus, has been immigrants are good for the economy and therefore good for us. So now they're starting to look at all these details more seriously. But the response from the elite, I think, has just fed suspicion and fed anger and fed resentment. And that worries me. So that for about a year now, I've been speculating, are we going to see another major war internationally, or are we going to see another major civil war in the Western countries?
So when do you think the genesis of this distrust, when were those seeds sown?
Well, I suspect it's been a gradual accumulation, which is why we've missed the significance of it. But I do remember I was one of the very few who back in 2016 speculated that maybe Trump might actually win. This is when he was just being dismissed and they thought, you know, if he gets selected as a Republican nominee, then that makes it a shoo-in for Hillary Clinton. And they laughed and they mocked and they ridiculed him. And instead he won. And I used the phrase in that, I think I wrote an article for the Japan Times saying, you know, he just might win. And it's a reaction from the elite that might take him over because the people are starting to respond to the scolds and the sneers who just tell them they're wrong, they're idiotic, they're bigoted, they're ignorant, etc. And that undermines the whole basis of democracy, that yes, individually people might get it wrong, but over time they do work things out and the wisdom of the crowds, if you like, that they collectively might have more wisdom than the elites. So it's been gradually firming in my mind, and it's also affecting global politics in terms of, you know, the very reasons that I was attracted to working for the United Nations, and I love my time in the United Nations. But they too are now catering much more to elite opinion and are part of that international elite themselves than to the opening words of the United Nations Charter, we the peoples. I think instead of trying to control what people believe, instead of moving towards thought police, as a lot of Western countries seem to be moving towards, utilizing to the maximum both existing and emerging surveillance technology, I think we need to sit back and say, now, do we think it is accidental that the best gains in life expectancy and human well-being and happiness have come through the democratic process, where good process ensures good policy and good policy delivers good politics as well, instead of retreating into more and more state controls and the nanny state and moving from education in schools and universities into outright indoctrination? So, yes, it is something that has worried me at the back of my mind in the past, and it's coming more and more to the front of the mind because it's becoming both more blatant and overt and more extreme.
Do you think, I mean, we've just now been a second assassination attempt on Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that both those perpetrators are sort of the end game of the social engineering of the elites within the media and the messaging over the last 10, 15 years?
I don't think it's that so much as both the attempts are symptoms of the increasing polarization and divisiveness and bitterness. We have lost the capacity, well, maybe we haven't lost it, but we are certainly approaching, we are losing, eroding our capacity to agree to disagree, to resolve our differences, not just peacefully, but amicably, to accept the outcomes and say, okay, we lost this election, but we'll wait till the next election. Instead of, in the case of Trump, going back to the 2016, there's no doubt anymore that the Democrats and his opponents are suffering from Trump derangement syndrome, just worked actively to undermine his presidency. And they had the chutzpah to say that it's Trump who refuses to accept the outcome of elections. I mean, that was, of any major country, Western country I'm aware of, the worst example of refusing to accept the verdict of the people. They worked and they made fake allegations about Russia collusion hoax. And almost to the end, they kept undermining him. And if you start painting the other side as evil, not just as people with difference of opinion, and if you disagree, then you work through the democratic process, through an independent but impartial media to advance your arguments and engage in the contest of ideas. Instead, you demonize, you vilify, you say they're the biggest threat to democracy. You say it's a second coming of Hitler, etc. Well, not surprisingly then, some people take that to the extreme of saying, well, if they're that bad, wouldn't the world have been better off if someone had taken a bullet to Hitler when he was still a young man? And that attitude begins to spread. But that exists on both sides. It's very difficult to find people saying, Well, I disagree with you, but I will defend to the death your right to disagree with me. That seems very quaint and old-fashioned now, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. And also, too, as you alluded to it before, the censorship that comes with this control. And there are two incidences that have happened in recent weeks, and I'd love to get your thoughts on them. First mm-hmm. is the arrest of Pavel Durov mm-hmm. in France, the founder of Telegram. And the second is the campaign in Brazil banning X, and more than that, going even a step further and making it illegal to use a VPN. What sort of precedent does that set?
Well, it's the rapid galloping of the technocratic surveillance state. I mean, in a previous interview, I think we discussed the thesis that after the Second World War, we had the rise of the national security state, where in the name of fighting the great evil of communism worldwide, we started imposing restrictions on people's freedoms and liberties and what they could write about and what they could do. Then we had the rise of the administrative state with parliament delegated increasing legislative or quasi-legislative authority to bureaucrats and technocrats, and the executive deferred making decisions or delegated that to the bureaucrats. And the judges began to accept the expertise of the bureaucrats and stayed out of that. And we've had a recent reversal of that in the US with the so-called Chevron defense. So that was the administrative state. And then we had the surveillance state, as witnessed by the fates of Julian Assange, now freed, but only after pleading guilty, and Edward Snowden. And all that fused and converged and came together in the biosecurity state under the pandemic, where for the first time that I can recall, they even started labeling information that they accepted as being accurate and truthful as nonetheless misinformation or harmful and therefore to be ruled not permissible. And you see that legally in the UK, for example, in the lawful but harmful category, and then the recording of non-crime hate incidents by the police. So we've gone a long way. And of course, remember, UK is the mother of democracies in this sense, and they've taken things for granted. It's part of that. And I believe not just Pavel Durov and Telegram, but I think Rumble, the alternative video channel, has also been banned in France as well as in Brazil and Russia and China. So you have the major Western democracies mimicking countries that they had previously and rightly called out for their censorship of ideas and their censorship of critics and deplatforming and even the arrest of critics. Would we 5 years ago have believed even in the possibility after the Charlie Hebdo controversy and the other things that France would be arresting the CEOs of major platforms and holding them responsible for the refusing to comply with the banning content and deplatforming content providers, saying, you know, we think this person is bad, you should not provide him a platform. Well, it's not the job of the state to do that. And I must say, one of the biggest disappointments in recent times on that argument was the US Supreme Court decision on very, very narrow technical grounds of standing, refusing to call out or investigate collusion between the US federal government and the tech platforms in the so-called Missouri versus Murphy case, where they said none of the complainants has standing to bring the case. Now I believe they have accepted or are about to accept that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. does have standing, so the case might still come up. But it'll be too late for this election. And yet, Supreme Court decisions, as we know, on a range of issues, have major political impacts. So it's a pity that they ducked out of that. I think it was an act of cowardice. Now, whether it was internal court politics in that we, the liberals, will concede on one, if you, the conservatives, concede on another, which this seems, there's certainly suggestions that that was part of the inner bargaining. It's one of the worst, most egregious cases of state and media and big tech collusion on censorship, and they really should have held it to be unconstitutional and punished the people responsible.
It's very much out in the open now. I mean, prior to the COVID crisis, no one took a second thought about potentially any censorship that was happening mm-hmm. in social media. And when we caught up last time, we were talking about democracy and in terms of like one third of the world was about to go to the polls. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more manipulation that goes on now. There have also been a tremendous amount of changes. And I find it interesting that the French have taken this pathway and been, I guess, in their eyes, very decisive about this level of censorship. And yet they're still struggling to cobble together a parliament after their elections with caretakers still very much in place and a lot of decisions still yet to be made and coalitions being unable to be formed.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the interesting contrast from the German reaction, isn't it?
Yeah.
The French president has clearly concluded that he hasn't acted firmly and decisively enough in coming down hard on wrongthink. Whereas the Germans are finally waking up to the fact that if they don't start listening, it might actually get a lot worse. And certainly I don't think they expected that the AfD would emerge as the party with the biggest number of votes. And you see Macron thumbing his nose at the electors by deciding to stay with the prime minister who got a very small minority of votes, percentage of votes, etc. So it may be things will need to get worse. But of course, to go back to where I was started off, and I often think back to a comment from the late President John F. Kennedy, not one of his better-known phrases, but he said, you know, if you make peaceful change impossible, you make violent revolution inevitable. Now, famously, at the end of the Cold War, Francis Fukuyama, Professor Fukuyama, articulated the thesis of the end of history. Well, that's been proven wrong. But equally, we seem to have concluded that we have gone well past the age of civil wars and revolutions. Well, certain patterns recur and mime in history. And civil wars and revolutions happen for a reason. And the big reason is the disconnect between the elites and the masses. When the elites lose complete touch with the feelings and emotions and aspirations, but also the disappointments and anger that builds up. And that's when people start looking for the nearest lamppost, or they start looking for the pikes on which to impale the decapitated heads of those that they're angry with. Now, I don't think we're going to go down that route, but there's no doubt about the alienation of the masses, the disgust with the so-called uniparty syndrome, where, you know, the anger that was palpable against the Tories in the UK, which explains the lopsided outcome. But the lopsided outcome disguises the fact, and I'd love to get a poll on how many people in Britain are aware that Keir Starmer in the last election won fewer votes than Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, look, the greatest winner in the UK election were those that abstained.
Yeah, or voted for other parties. And the gap between reform and the others is now so narrow that the slight shifts will begin to affect the outcomes. You know, it's at the point where little shifts in percentage of shares of voting will have dramatic differences in the outcomes in numbers of seats win. Now, against all that, may I just add that one big hopeful sign was the country that has the biggest elections in the democratic world, biggest number of voters, and that's India, where they didn't go all the way to voting for the opposition, but they cut back quite significantly on the single majority status of the BJP and have forced Prime Minister Modi to work in coalition and therefore learn the art of compromise and negotiation with allies. And that's a hopeful sign. Similarly, you know, to go back to Rumble and Elon Musk and Pavel Durov and even Zuckerberg, two of the three said no to government efforts to control. Musk actually has paid quite a heavy financial price for buying out Twitter and making X a champion instead of an opponent of free speech. And Zuckerberg has, his letter to Congress is very interesting. He may have come to the party late, but he has accepted and publicly acknowledged that they did comply and that they shouldn't have complied, that they should resist more. And they are resisting the efforts in Australia to impose controls, for example. And the Telegram, as we know, the CEO is in jail, but he still hasn't backed down as far as I know. So maybe the message is getting through to the corporate sector. And I think in the corporate sector in Australia, they haven't said so, but my impression would be that a lot of them have indeed concluded that it was a mistake to get involved in the voice debate, that the corporate sector should not get involved in social and political issues. And the more controversial they are, the better for them to stay out of that and stay neutral. So maybe there will be enough pushback and dawning recognition. We'll just have to wait and see. But in the meantime, the online harms bills in the UK, I don't know New Zealand, but in Canada certainly, and in Australia certainly, is very concerning. And to go back to something you said, in the fullness of time, the godmother of all these efforts to impose government-enforced censorship might well turn out to be Jacinda Ardern and her infamous comment about, we will be your single source of truth on all matters to do with COVID. That's what it boils down to.
A lot of it, too, has also bubbled up alternatives and parallel structures, which we've never seen the like of before.
No.
And I mean, you brought it up before with Elon Musk buying Twitter. And interestingly enough with that, when you speak with Jack Dorsey, and I mean, he stayed very quiet for the longest time, but he's now again started speaking out here and there. He felt embattled, I think, by this federal pressure to help conform. And sort of he went to ground, really. And Zuckerberg's now come to the party late. Looking at some of the things that have happened in Europe at the moment, there are hope, because for the longest time, in terms of this ideological push for things very much to the left, and where the Overton window shunted leftwards in Europe was under Angela Merkel in Germany and those open borders. And Douglas Murray wrote about it in 2017 in his book, The Strange Death of Europe. And you touched on it now with the AfD winning in those two regions of what was former East Germany. Mm-hmm. But it was the youth, that's what got me. It was the young people that voted overwhelmingly. And we also saw that happen in Argentina with Javier Milei. It was the 18 to 24-year-olds that got him across the line. Is this the light at the end
and
of the tunnel?
And it's happening in Canada. Did you know that?
With Pierre Poilievre?
He is in that category, in that youth group, in that age group. He is 20% ahead of Justin Trudeau as preferred prime minister. It's quite extraordinary. So the youth, again, in Canada, as in these other countries, are disproportionately now breaking for the Conservative Party. And you're right, you know, the first major government that actually forms government in what used to be derided as the far right was Italy and Giorgia Meloni. Then you've had movements, successful movements, dramatically impactful movements in the Netherlands. And of course, Hungary, you have a very successful leader there. So yes, I think it is spreading. The political center of gravity has unquestionably shifted in Europe. You've gotten the Reform UK and Nigel Farage in Parliament, and maybe only with four seats, but they hadn't got any before. Mm. And the percentage of votes for them was quite remarkable. And the fact that only one out of five every eligible voter voted for Labour and Keir Starmer. They govern as if they got a mandate. In fact, I think it's much more accurate to say the Tories were turfed out with the white-hot anger against 14 wasted years of government and an 80-seat majority. And people are fed up of Conservatives being a Labour light. You certainly sense that in Australia. It was certainly true in the UK. Again, I don't know enough in New Zealand. It seems to be that the government still has a margin for doing things. But if the centre-right parties are going to try and mimic, with a lighter touch, what the centre-left parties do, and the centre-left parties govern with an element of conviction, then that guarantees long-term return to power at centre-left. I'd rather vote for people who believe in what they stand for when in government, than people who say one thing with embarrassment but actually do something else. And that's going to be there. I think, I certainly hope, that that message is getting through, that we return to a genuine contest of ideas of not just fundamental organizing principles of society and the political system, but what that means for policy. and present clear alternatives. And in that sense, incidentally, the one and only debate between Trump and Harris, I think, has been very interesting. There's pretty much overwhelming agreement, both amongst the critics and media commentators, but also in public opinion polls, that Kamala Harris won the debate. I think it's 2-1, the margin that say that. And yet the polls have barely shifted. And I think that is because people have also picked up on the inauthenticity of Harris and the fact that she spent more time baiting and goading and rubbishing Trump than answering the questions and actually articulating what it is she stands for.
The strategy.
As you know, these memorized canned answers, a few phrases that she memorized.
No, she was very, very well prepared by a team to set bear traps for Donald Trump. And unfortunately, he walked into many of them. The thing I found, I haven't seen any commentators bring this up, is that to me, she actually had a memory problem almost as bad as Joe Biden's, because she seemed to forget that she's the current incumbent, not opposition runner.
Memory problem. I think that is a deliberate strategy to try and distance herself from the administration. And Trump kept coming back to that. Now, again, don't get me wrong. I think it is a flaw on Trump's part that he is so easily baited, and he can't blame her for his own bad performance. But what interests me is the gap between people who say who won the debate and the failure to move the needle on the polls. In fact, it's now, even before the second assassination attempt, gradually been shifting back towards Trump anyway. And the American system is such that the Democrats need a clear margin in the polls for that to translate into victory on Election Day. This is assuming there's no
meaningful polls,
manipulation of the voting itself, which, you know, you expect a little bit here and there, but whether it'll be enough or not. So I still think it remains very much even, and there's still time for it to produce surprises. It's been a very strange election day.
Well, it is, and that's even before you get into the legitimacy of her candidacy. I mean, that was a palace coup.
It isn't. It can't be legitimate. They subverted the entire democratic process. And it was clearly very intentional. And I said that in my article that, you know, we knew Biden's cognitive and physical frailty challenges when 2024 rolls around. They could have insisted, well, they could have tried to persuade him to drop out as he had promised 4 years ago. Or they could have insisted, if he didn't, on an open primary and tested the candidates out. Or they could have left the debate schedule as per every 4 years in the normal calendar. But instead, scheduling that debate before the Democratic Party convention, but after the Republicans. So the Republican candidate is not locked in. They still haven't chosen theirs. And he just bombs. And then they just shove aside the 14 million people who voted decisively for Biden. Harris is not even a contestant. And that she gets handed the throne, the crown, to be the Democrats' champion. That's, I mean, you know, the sharpest comment that has actually come from, again, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. But Trump has said that as well. So the 14 million people disregarded, and the people buy in. Well, that does a lot to undermine your faith in the democratic process, I'm afraid. So had she contested the primary and emerged triumphant, or even as a credible alternative by the time Biden implodes, that would have been fine. But to sit that out and then do this like this, and the people who were making these arguments and contesting the primary were vilified by the party establishment. So how they can claim to be the defenders of democracy again and belittle Trump as a threat to democracy. And if most people are prepared to buy that, then I'll return to India as still proving some faith in democracy rather than the United States.
It really just leans to then the deceit of the Democrats is probably the greatest threat to democracy in the United States as opposed to an individual like Donald Trump.
Well, I think the Democratic Party is the bigger threat to long-term and more serious threat to U.S. democracy in terms of how they behaved in post-2016, in terms of how they behaved in 2020, and the argument from, I think it was Victor Davis Hanson who put that argument about the triple coup. And then the way they have behaved this year. Because now it is all the different levers, institutional levers of the elite that are coming together. You can survive on one individual as one bad term. You can't survive the system actually, you know, the empire striking back and with great success. So I think the chances of protecting the core elements of the US democratic system will diminish quite substantially if in fact they succeed in this overt and covert manipulation and pressure points and censorship and manipulation.
Mm. Who do you think will take it out?
I would still think the chances are more that Trump will win. But there's, you know, two big things we don't know still. One is how the rest of this weird election year plays out. And we haven't even got into this traditional October surprise. That's one thing. The second thing is with the new tools at their disposal now, we have no way of knowing the extent of manipulation of the actual voting process. The United States has one of the most questionable degrees of ballot integrity in the democratic world. I have more faith in a mass illiterate country like India actually producing outcomes that reflect popular vote than I have in the US. You know, think of it. The Democratic Party insisted on voter ID for people to enter the convention hall at their party convention. But they think voter ID for actual election is racist. This is just brazen as well as blatant hypocrisy, let alone the ballot harvesting and the postal votes and all that. So no, again, the Supreme Court, I think, has ducked this issue. Sometimes on issues of standing, sometimes on, well, you know, you have to provide the evidence. Well, it's very hard to provide evidence if you refuse to investigate, just as with the claims of far right and misinformation and stuff like that. If you don't give the information, you create an information vacuum, which is filled by conspiracy theories. And it doesn't help you, as with COVID, if so many of the conspiracy theories from this year are proven right in the following year. So all that contributes to the lack of, you know, where we started off, the growing distrust of what we are told, not just by the government, but by the media. And go back to the debate. They fact-checked repeatedly Trump and got their fact-checks wrong. So if you actually fact-check the fact-checkers, they were wrong. And some of those claims, Trump was right. And they just gave a complete pass to Kamala Harris. So if you don't trust the media and you don't trust the establishment institutions on the governance side, who are you left with? Well, on the positive side, Murray, it's one of the reasons for the success of institutions like yours, Reality Check Radio and others. People are desperate to get other points of view. Their confidence and faith in the establishment media having been broken, they're looking to alternative media. And and so the attempt to control and regulate the alternative media. And again, blatant enough that they say, if you disagree with official line or if you disagree with the experts, then you're guilty of misinformation.
The United Kingdom are really clamping down, and especially Scotland too, on speech and what can be said and the definitions of what can be said. And there is some very woolly language and loose definitions on hurty words.
Mm-hmm. And the thing to remember on that is the more loose the language, the greater the scope for censorship and enforcement of whatever you want to enforce.
So how long, considering that Keir Starmer in reality didn't get a mandate from the British people, how long do you think he'll be able to last and how much damage do you think he'll be able to do before the people wake up and stand up?
Well, the UK is unique in regard to that question because despite that lack of mandate, he has a huge majority in Parliament. And so the fact that X number of MPs vote against and a very substantial minority abstain makes not the slightest difference. And remember, in the British system, you can get through whatever you want in Parliament and that becomes the law. At the same time, his popularity has plummeted. The honeymoon period was astonishingly short and he's just not liked by the people. So yes, he has a 5-year term, but the way things are going, I don't see, unless they've taken the line that we'll get all the unpopular decisions through in the first year, and then we have the legislative and institutional framework in place to coast after that. So all the net zero policies that they're imposing, people are starting to rebel against that. You know, the idea, look, you didn't need governments to give you incentives to switch from bicycles to cars. people saw the convenience and attractiveness of motorized transport and went for that. The fact that they're mandating and punishing car manufacturers, if you don't produce X percentage of vehicles that are electric vehicles, then we will fine you so much per car, or we'll give you subsidy if you do. And despite that, what is it? Ford is losing about, or is it General Motors? $150,000 per EV sold, something like that. And I think one of the European, is it Fiat, that has given a month's holiday to its EV workforce because people are just not buying it, and they're starting to scale back on those. At some stage, just as happened with the old communist regimes across Europe, not just in the Soviet Union, reality bites.
Mm.
You can't just mandate targets and quotas. We are doing that. We are saying, by law, we define this to be true. And it takes you back to saying, well, you know, if one country says, if you affirm a genocide of these people took place, that is a crime. Nothing happened by law. And the other country says the opposite. There is an objective reality in the world out there. And sooner or later, legal fiction, if it collides with reality, will be destroyed. So that sort of thing will happen. The impact of these will already be felt for decades to come. Immigration is the best example. We talked about the mass immigration and the economic consequences of that. Well, those people are there, and they will be there for the next 4, 5, 6 decades.
Mm.
And therefore, the costs will be felt until then. Going back to your question about the Starmer government, the visuals of mass release of convicted prisoners from jails and them celebrating with champagne and saying, we are Labour voters for life, those visuals will remain in the memories of the people even 5 years down the line. So let's see what happens. I think if there is a, you know, the next big thing in the UK will be the Tory leadership, which I think is early November that we'll know, and who the leader is and how they start performing in Parliament. I think the other big thing is going to be whether, in fact, they ally, even tactically in Parliament and outside, with reform, or whether they devote more effort into fighting reform and Farage rather than fighting Labour and Starmer. That's going to affect not just UK politics, but the fate of the Tory party itself.
Mm.
So it's a lot more volatile politically and a lot more uncertain than we are accustomed to, particularly in terms of stable two-party systems in the UK, in New Zealand. New Zealand has already changed since MMP changed quite a lot, but essentially it's still been around there. And its party allegiances are breaking apart, getting much looser and much softer. And people are prepared to switch quite dramatically. And as you said earlier, and quite rightly, the shifting patterns of political views of the young people is coming as a shock to parties that have traditionally counted on solid majorities. Just as, again, the shifts in allegiance from the blacks and the Hispanics in the US has been an eye-opener for the Democratic Party. And it will be interesting if in the end, if votership in these constituencies determines the outcome of the US presidential election.
Mm.
So things are happening. One thing we can trust political parties to do is to react to their survival instinct. And if they start losing voting cohorts, they will self-correct.
Yeah.
So that remains one of the abiding hopes of democratic systems, that it has built-in self-correcting mechanisms, where parties and leaders are forced to respond. They can keep trying to censor and control and enforce, but I don't think efforts at thought control and conformism are going to be permanently a feature of human society. So in that sense, I remain, if you like, ultimately optimistic, if a bit less so than I used to be.
I'm going to pivot slightly, but the theme is very much the same, to an area that you know very well. Mpox. Now, is this a crude attempt at the same shit, different day, or is it an attempt by the WHO to try and claw back some of the relevance and trust that they've lost in the eyes of the people after COVID?
It's neither. I think it's the WHO responding to the incentives we have created for them. It's very much in their organizational and financial interest to declare pandemics. It gives them more personnel. It gives them more money. It gives them more powers. And if they declare a pandemic and it proves not to be as grave as they predicted, then they claim victory and success. It's our early warning that helped us avert, and thank you all very much for cooperating and supporting. If they don't declare it and it does happen, then they suffer. So there's a perverse incentive created for them to go early, go hard, go more dramatic. I don't think it's possible to reform the WHO anymore. I think we need an organization to coordinate global health in terms of early warning and surveillance and response capability and mobilizing response. But there's too much of a vested interest that has corrupted the WHO. That's not unique to the WHO. I think it happens to every organization. If they have been around too long, then the interests of the organization are prioritized over the original mission that brought about the organization in the first place. I think that is what has happened with the WHO. There's no correlation anymore between what the WHO wants to focus on, even in Africa, and what the real big killer diseases in Africa are. Per day, how many people, even in the height of the Mpox crisis, how many people in Africa were dying from TB, from malaria, from HIV, AIDS, etc., and other infectious diseases, cholera is another one, compared to how many died from Mpox. So this is the priorities that reflects the international technocratic elite, which coincidentally happens to give them more relevance, more powers, more budgets, etc. You see the same thing with the focus on net zero. Is that the biggest benefit, focusing on that, for the developing countries in terms of their priorities and their real threats to huge numbers of people? Or is it something else? So I think you have this discrepancy between the international institutions that are dominated by the Western way of thinking, even if it is people from other countries. Their educational background and their worldviews reflects the Western elites rather than the average citizens in their own country. And that distorts the priorities, it distorts the activities, it distorts the budgets. And of course, more and more, including in the WHO, we've gone away from core budget, which allows them to set their own priorities as they want, as per their expertise and beliefs, into directed funding, where they have to respond to what the funders want.
Who are the funders, and how do they, what pressure can be applied to them to stop the nonsense?
The big government funders in WHO are the United States and Germany and the European Union and the UK. The big private sector funders, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and through them also other organizations of the health like the Gavi Alliance and some others. CEPI is another international network. It's a small number of people in that field that scratch one another's backs and look after each other. And it's the same people whose names crop up in there. And I think that's been a lot more influential in the health sector than this World Economic Forum in Geneva. I think the government should pay to core budget and restrict the extent to which private actors are involved. Private actors are much more self-interested than philanthropic, and that's understandable. Let them make money, that's fine. But you claw back that through the tax system and then direct to the public interest rather than to private interest. So I think we're certainly well into the era of you subsidize the risks, socialize the risks, and privatize the profits. And philanthropy can be very profitable these days if you pursue the right channels.
But if the people start to distrust the government, and they certainly start to distrust international bodies like the WHO, how long will it take before that filters up to cut the head off the snake? Or if the WHO do persist and they try to look at the things like their pandemic policy and the like, that people just go, no, no, no.
Well, that's happening at the national level. Look at the recommendations for the booster shots for COVID from pretty much any Western government, and look at the minuscule actual take-up of the boosters in the population. even in the most vulnerable groups, like the elderly, people have stopped listening. And the media doesn't highlight the huge amount of wastage in terms of the vaccines that are being thrown out, not being used, just stored and then become obsolete. You know, if you and I were to apply for a government grant for $10,000, we'd have to give incredible details and accounting. But $10 billion, what's that?
Mm.
You know, I mean, do you have any idea of the amount of wastage in New Zealand?
No.
You're getting the figures. It's huge.
Yeah, there are people that are working on OAAs in that mm-hmm. area, but they keep that very buttoned down.
They do indeed.
And I think financially as well, we're on a precipice potentially of an even larger financial crisis, particularly as many of those mortgages, those subprime mortgages in the United States, are coming off their fixed time periods from those all-time lows. And it will be a very interesting time to see what happens. And I spoke to a speculator recently, and he's based in Argentina, so he's a huge fan of Javier. And he does wonder, are we now living in the back end of the 20s, and are we going to see a financial implosion like the 30s happen again?
Probably. And to link it to our main topic for today, of course, there's increasing signs of collusion towards a digital currency,
mm-hmm.
which will enable them to track everything we do. So, and I think I did say this in an earlier conversation with you or one of your colleagues. I have made a conscious decision to switch back to using cash wherever I can and whenever I can. And the fact that my international travel has declined by my choice quite substantially increases my ability to use cash rather than electronic payments. And I know I'm doing that. It's mainly motivated by a desire to restore the balance between freedom from surveillance at the cost of some convenience. And I'm happy to do that. But also in part because I do want to keep these jobs going in an environment where jobs are becoming more and more scarce. And these are not necessarily the best paid. You know, then you go to a supermarket and you start do self-checkout. Well, that's definitely fewer checkout people who can be employed, sort of thing. So it's both. But I think we are going to have to sit back and question, do we want that degree of safety, of personal safety, of health safety, at the cost of giving up our freedoms and freedom of choice to governments and to firms? Or are we going to accept a measure of inconvenience? It is not possible to have a free society without free speech. And speech is fundamental and central to free choice in every sphere of human activity. Now, we can go back to Orwell and Huxley and Brave New World and 1984 and accept that the governments will look after us from the cradle to the grave, and the way things are going from before the cradle to after the grave. Or we can say, no, we are losing sight of what is important to us as human beings, and we'd like to restore a better balance between the provision of services, including security and safety and health, and accept an element of risk that actually makes life worth living and meaningful.
Yeah. And actually, that brings us really to the final paragraph of your article. You say here, and you returned to India for a doctoral research in 1975 based in New Delhi. In June of that year, Prime Minister Indira Gandhi declared a national emergency and ruled for 2 years as a dictator, jailing political opponents and critics, imposing wide-ranging media censorship and curtailing civil liberties. My first academic article was a lament for the loss of democratic freedoms in India. My overall lessons from that lived, very triggering language there, Ramesh, from that lived experience. First, we tend not to really appreciate the rarity and value of a free society until we lose it. Second, democracy rests ultimately in a belief in the good sense of the people. I fear that in 2 months, should American voters elect Kamala Harris as the next president, they will discover the truth of the first and invalidate the second lesson. And that's a very powerful point indeed.
Thank you.
Well, that, of course, has come from an article in the Brownstone Institute dated September 6th. It's entitled Why the Ruling Class Fears Democracy. So do make sure you hunt that out. We'll make sure we have a link to that article in our show notes. Professor Ramesh Thakurt, as always, it is such a joy to talk to you. And there were some little hints of positivity in there. So, and I think we just need to remain hopeful and vigilant.
We do. And, the part of the conversation that dealt with the changing views of the youth, the young people, that's the biggest hope. I mean, they need to recognize that this is all about their future. The likes of people like me have had our day, for better or worse, and we need to create a better world for them. And you can't have a better world that's not a free world. And yes, you can't have a free world without free speech. So on that note, thank you again, Murray.
You're most welcome, and indeed, don't disappear. Of course, we've still got great content here to come with Reality Check Radio with Marie. You're with Counterculture, and I'll be back shortly.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.